Welcome to New Books in Food. I'm your moderator, and my name is Valerie St. Rossi. Today, I'm very pleased to be speaking with Jeff Kohler about his book, Where the Wild Coffee Grows, The Untold Story of Coffee from the Cloud Forests of Ethiopia to Your Cup. It was published by Bloomsbury in 2017. Jeff, welcome to New Books in Food.
Thanks.
The first question I have is life possible without coffee?
Not for me. and not for a lot of people. As I kind of write in the book, I mean, there's really no other substance that kind of holds sway over the human experience like coffee, you know. I quote somebody in the book who said, essentially, you know, if it's not indispensable to man's happiness, then it certainly contributes a good deal to it. I think very few people would argue that conceit, and I know that many, including myself, would take it much, much further.
Well, further, why don't we go a little further since you brought that up? Is it simply gastronomical, or is it other as well?
No, I mean, there's so many elements of it, but, I make in quite a few cups a day, actually. I probably prepare at least 4 or 5 cups a day. And certainly I don't actually finish any of those. That's quite rare. You know, to start with is the entire process of preparing coffee that I like and is part of that ritual. And so, you know, you start with that. Because I work at home, it's often an excuse to get up from my desk and to, you know, go in the kitchen and make coffee and, you know, it starts there, and it, you know, it ends at the taste, but it's just so much more than that. The simple fact of being, you know, a beverage or a caffeinated beverage. Of course, the caffeine is a really important part of coffee's historical importance and why it is the center of, you know, many, many great things that kind of help drive, you know, kept you awake or inspiration, whatever. I mean, there's so many parts to it.
So in other words, you're not like Flaubert with his 40 cups per day.
No, not fully, but I do get a fair amount. And when I was working on the book in Ethiopia, I was drinking a lot of coffee, and you're every night you're hard of a hard time going to sleep. You're so wound up on the caffeine and of course everything you've been doing and seeing and talking about and experiencing, but there's endless cups of coffee. You know, in Ethiopia, it's such a social drink. I mean, this is one of the things that I clearly saw the first time I went, compared to many modern coffee shops today, is that coffee is 100% social drink. You know, coffee is not drunk alone. It's usually other people. And second, meetings always have coffee. And so, when you're there, you tend to drink a lot because it's a very social culture and with a lot of people. And that's something that I really actually appreciated, was this social element of coffee. And if you compare it to going into many cafes today and it's just quiet and everybody's staring at their screens, and you make, you know, too much noise, people kind of glare at you. That's a very different element than I saw in Ethiopia. But also, that social element of coffee drinking and cafes and coffee houses, I mean, that is where it began. The original coffee house was a very social place, a very noisy place. It wasn't an extension of an office by any stretch of the imagination.
And those first coffee houses were in the early 1500s, weren't they? You say in your book they began in Aden and in Mecca.
Yeah, and then they started spreading up around, you know, in Cairo and Damascus and Baghdad and Istanbul. I think the first one in Istanbul was around 1555. At that time, restaurants, you know, didn't really exist. And they were places where people could go and socialize. And this was the beginning of coffee's kind of popularity. And they spread quite quickly. You know, in Istanbul, there was something like 600 coffee houses within simply 2 decades. They spread to Europe quite quickly. And in England, for instance, they were a great option instead of the pub. You know, for many reasons. But one is, you know, with ale, it just kind of dulled your intellect, where coffee had the opposite effect. You know, it made you smarter and brighter and sharper and wittier. And, you know, the great English coffee houses with people like, you know, Milton and Boswell and Samuel Johnson and you know, all these great poets and politicians, they met and they gathered in these coffee houses. And, you know, it was this place to be, but the coffee itself, that caffeine, you know, made them somehow brighter, which, you know, the pub next door kind of made you duller.
It's an interesting contrast. And I believe that was the birth of Lloyd's in London. Lloyd's was first a coffee house, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah. The coffee houses, they were were the center. I mean, they started many things. A lot of, you know, newspapers began there, or a lot of things kind of began. People kind of clustered around these coffee houses.
And we're talking about how coffee spread, but your book explains to us where coffee comes from and the things that we don't know about the beginning of coffee, Ethiopia and the cloud forest. Please tell us a little about that.
Certainly the center of origin and diversity, as they say, is the cloud forest of Ethiopia. So basically, just to back up one small step, it's basically two widely cultivated species of coffee, Arabica, which is what we're talking about today, and Robusta, which is a much more tropical thing. So talking about fine coffee and good coffee, we're talking about Arabica. So the center of origin and diversity of Arabica coffee is in these cloud forests of Ethiopia, predominantly in the southwest of the country, a couple hundred miles from Addis Ababa. And today, the core of the wild coffee forest kind of fall within this region known as Kaffa. And so this is an isolated region of valleys and dense forests and kind of hamlets. The people are subsistence farmers by and large. They forage for coffee in the wild. They grow it in their gardens. You know, as I write, they buy it, they sell it, they hoard until the prices go up. And in the meantime, they're drinking a lot of coffee. And it, for the people in the highlands where it does grow wild, it's really in Kaffa, it's 100% of the population is kind of gets its main source of income from coffee. So this is the origin, but this still today is a real Eden of coffee. It's, you know, still grows in the wild. People still forage for it. And it's, as I argue in the book, not only the source of coffee as a plant, but it's the world's original coffee culture.
And I think that you mentioned that in Ethiopia, coffee is called, this is our bread. Coffee is our bread.
Well, I mean, it's certainly there all the time. And it's just so much of a part of life. And Kaffa and this area where it grows wild is an extreme version of that. I mean, they're drinking, you know, 8 or 9 cups a day. They start giving it to kids as soon as they start walking. Coffee is just always present. You know, if you smell or you hear it being prepared in this kind of elaborate process where they roast the beans first, you can simply go in and there'll always be a cup for you. I mean, they're always preparing extra. You know, again, it's at its heart, it's a social, really important element. You know, it's really the glue that holds together a really large and diverse country. And as I said, it's an extreme version of that is in this place where it does grow wild in the forest also.
I have a rather pedestrian question to bring up, which is people are worried about drinking too much caffeine in the course of a day. It's the way you're describing Ethiopians, that does not enter into the question. People in the West think, oh, caffeine will have a very bad effect on my health. That does not sound like the thinking of Ethiopians. So which is true?
In this area in Kaffa that I'm describing, where the wild coffee grows in the cloud forest, and this is a really, you know, poor area. You know, there's if you live outside of the capital, Bunga, you know, there's no electricity and no running water. I mean, I think a lot of people have other issues to deal with health-wise, maybe more pressing than too much caffeine. I get asked that question all the time, but nobody, when I was there, seemed to, you know, think anything of it. It's just part of, you know, their daily life and the pleasure and the importance of these small little cups of coffee that they're drinking is absolutely fundamental.
I was also informed when I was growing up that if I drank coffee, it would stunt my growth. Have you ever heard that? I have to say that I therefore did not drink any coffee, and I am 5 feet tall.
I have heard that, but I didn't come upon that from the scientific community when I was working on my book. But I can remember hearing that also when I was growing up.
Where did that come from?
I don't know.
Not from Ethiopia, correct?
I don't know. I don't think so, no.
Well, the next thing I wonder if you could talk a little about is the cloud forest, the coffee, Caffea Arabica, is misnamed. How did that happen?
Arabica means from Arabia. And indeed, it was misnamed. That goes back to the 1730s. There was the great Carlos Linnaeus, at that time was a young Swedish botanist, still unknown. And he was in Amsterdam, and he went to visit a summer estate about 30 kilometers, about 20 miles or so outside of Amsterdam, called Hartekamp, where the owner had this incredible summer place, and he had built four greenhouses for plants from all over the world, and he had this incredible library, research library, and a world-class herbarium with thousands of these dried specimens. And Linnaeus at that time was working on a system of classifying plants, and Clifford was very impressed by him, and he offered him a job, and part of the job was to not only take care of the garden, but was to catalog the collection to prepare a record of its contents. And this task was really interesting for Linnaeus. So he started working on the living and the dried plants, and among the dried plants was coffee. So when Linnaeus was looking at it, he rejected its previous classification, which was a laurel, and he made a new genus for it, which was Caffea. He left Holland and went back to Sweden, and he continued to work on his system of classifying plants and then animals. And later kind of refined his classification. And at that time, it was believed that coffee was coming from Arabia, and he thought the same. And so when he gave it its official binomial name, he named it Caffea Arabica, which means from Arabia. And this...
Why did he believe that?
Well, at that point, very few historical documents pointed towards coffee source across the Red Sea. Yemen was, and its port of Mocha for, you know, for 200 years was had a monopoly basically on selling coffee. You know, Yemen was the first place to cultivate coffee on a commercial scale. And Arabia was also I'm sorry?
They got the plants from Ethiopia?
Yemen was the source of coffee's global spread. So even if it didn't originate in Arabia, it had played an incredibly important role in cultivated coffee. So essentially for two centuries, it had a near monopoly on selling the beans, but it just became too popular not to spread. And kind of by 1720 is when it peaked. And within 3 decades, it was already growing on 5 continents. Arabica grows easily and it spreads rapidly and it's uniform and stable and in the right conditions, it absolutely thrives. Today it's cultivated in around 40 countries or so that kind of stretch around the equator, kind of roughly between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. And if you kind of allot for nuances in the way that you're producing it and so on and certain terroir, I mean, it's pretty familiar. A cup of Arabica that's grown in Guatemala, tastes, generally speaking here, quite similar to a cup from Kenya or from Tanzania if it's, dried and roasted and brewed in the same manner. This
There is a difference between the taste of Robusta and the taste of Arabica, isn't
exactly.
there?
So Robusta is, as I said, there are two main kinds of coffee, and Arabica is, it's finer and it's just a much higher flavor. Robusta is, less mild and, and it's stronger. It's got a higher caffeine level, but it has this kind of burnt rubberish kind of flavor to it. It's tropical, so it needs, grows much lower elevation. But it's, as I said, when we talk about fine coffee, we're talking about Arabica, and it's still a majority of coffee that's grown. Robusta is
Where
increasing,
did
but Arabica is still a majority of coffee produced.
Robusta originate?
Well, there's a lot of it is around Central Africa, some around Uganda. There's some different kind of patches of it, but it's more of a kind of tropical African plant. Although there's a lot, it was taken out of Africa and planted in Indonesia, for instance. They grow a lot of it in Vietnam today. This past year was about 40% of the global coffee was Robusta.
And the uses for Robusta are somewhat different industrially,
Well,
aren't
it has
they?
a lot. It's a lot higher caffeine, and it's a lot
Commercially, I mean.
less expensive to produce. So you are, you're using a lot of the caffeine in sodas and so on. But also, it uses in blend, and I think what we're seeing is that it's being blended more and more and more into or with Arabica. So the pure Arabica, coffee used to generally be pure Arabica, but I think now you're getting in the supermarket lots of blends and they're putting some of this into it little by little. It seems to be increasing.
As a consumer of coffee, what is it that people don't know that they should know about the worldwide crop,
Well,
about
I think that,
anything?
well, there's two things I think that again, hopefully people get from this book. One is your question earlier about the source and about its origins and looking at this original coffee culture. For me, that was, to start with is that it's from Ethiopia and, to tell that story out there, about the forest and so on. But second is the idea that, that this was the original coffee culture. For me, it never really made sense that, it normally it's the Turks or the Arabs that tend to get credit for developing or inventing coffee. Where for me, it seemed like the people that, those living in around the forest who grew it were undoubtedly the first to prepare it. These are forest people. They use or utilize every item in the forest, including coffee. These beautiful bright red, very tempting fruits that when you take them in your mouth, they have kind of a little sweetness to them, and you have these two seeds or these two beans, and you have this kind of energizing effect from the caffeine. The logical thing for me is that it began there, and so in the forest, these wild forests, I asked a lot of questions about trying to get to that source, and the old stories about where coffee kind of came from. And one thing that I found that was really interesting is that, you know, it probably began as a food, you know, people eating these coffee fruit, these, we'll call cherries, these red ripe coffee fruits. And eventually, you know, it came to the beans and eventually roasting the beans. And you know, somebody said to me, you know, eventually we put everything on the fire. And as soon as you start roasting the coffee beans, you're eventually going to make kind of a drink out of it. But the other point that goes with that is that probably the first drink that came from the coffee tree was actually an infusion from the coffee leaves. You know, they still make this kind of, you know, tisane with dried coffee leaves. It's long been popular. It's, you know, you take, you have to think that you have these ripe coffee beans on the tree for, say, a month, a year, but you have the leaves all year round. And they dry them, and then they can kind of toast them in the pan, and they taste, for me, a little bit like a real light pu'er. They're kind of earthy flavor with this natural sweetness.
Sorry to interrupt. So in other words, coffee is really a product of a primary environment. It would be maybe the high mountain version of Amazonian subsistence. It's growing on trees. We live near the trees.
Yes,
we eat it.
You know, people live in forests. They utilize what they have. I mean, just surviving takes an incredible amount of energy and effort. And you know, you're trying things, you know, over many you know centuries, and developing ways to utilize these forest products. You know, coffee is simply one plant in the forest. And this is something that for me that was really interesting to see being in the forest was that, you know, cultivated coffee is there because it's meant to be there. You know, it's planted, you know, it produces fruit because it's supposed to produce fruit. In the forest, the wild coffee is there because it survived. You know, there's a lot of plants that want that space, you know, that wants that light and those nutrients. But that coffee tree that you're seeing, it's there because it won that place in the forest. You know, it's there because it survived. And it has many, you know, it has various roles. So you see these old coffee trees, they tend to be quite skinny. They grow upwards towards light. They're only producing enough coffee cherries to simply perpetuate the species. I mean, the energy goes into survival. So they tend to be covered in moss. You know, they have a role. So you have these trees covered in this, you know, kind of beardy moss that, you know, it basically the trees get wet, it attracts some dirt, eventually get mosses and so on. And, you know, critters live in that moss. You know, it's a host for, you know, pollinators and for insects and so on. I mean, it has its role as it lives under this, you know, it's under the main canopy. It's a second tier tree, but it definitely has its role in the forest. And this is another element to me that I think people don't really understand is that, you know, coffee in this natural self produces actually quite little. And it's a heavily shaded tree. It does not live in the open.
In other words, the tree itself is a member of a community, and it contributes lots to the forest community. It isn't simply there for people to pick the berries.
Absolutely, these are very, very rich, biodiverse,
and it's elevated,
forests.
Isn't it?
Arabica is a very sensitive plant that kind of grows within a relatively small band. Elevation. And so, yeah, these are highlands. So these are highland cloud forests.
I'm curious to know, in the time that you spent researching this book, what was something or a few things that really surprised you as you were learning about coffee?
Well, within the forest, this idea that the coffee forest is just chaos and there's just trees everywhere and, you know, the trees are bent down from people picking them, but also from the animals, you know, these ripe fruits are beloved by baboons, certain monkeys, and lots of birds. These are a big threat, or for people that are collecting the fruits, competition, if you want to call it that. But also, these animals are responsible for sowing the seeds around the forest. So certain birds in particular, they pick them up and they carry the fruits and they eat it and they drop the seed and new trees sprout up around.
I'm thinking now about coffee that is poured into a paper cup and covered with a plastic lid. Can you talk a little about how the cloud canopy tree is now somewhere so far from its original ambiance?
Yeah, it has changed, but I guess what was interesting though is that in its wild state, coffee is extremely similar to cultivated coffee. I think it's one of the products, I would say, that is the most similar to the, wildly commercial cultivated crop. You take like carrots or something, they're unrecognizable from what we're getting now. While that we're drinking coffee differently, is interesting that it remains so similar. So you go into this cloud forest, and the actual coffee beans that the coffee fruit you're collecting are quite similar. It's the trees that are different, as I said earlier. They're skinny, they grow upwards towards the light, and they're producing very, very little. But the cherries, the coffee cherries themselves, are surprisingly similar.
Now, this is a primary raw material grown in a certain part of the world and consumed in another part of the world. The Ethiopians actually drink this primary resource.
Yes, and this is one thing that's very different is that, Kenya, for instance, it consumes only about 3% of its own coffee. I think Colombia is around 86% of its coffee is being exported. Ethiopia is different. Ethiopia is consuming over half of its production. And this is a country, this is one of the biggest producers in the world. They consume a lot of it. Now, this idea that it is by and large produced in, poor countries and exported into richer ones is quite different than, for instance, rice or wheat. And this is one of the reasons why it's called an orphan crop. So there was often little invested into the research and development of it, where you take rice, for instance, that is, grown and consumed in, say, Japan or China and in many countries. They were growing it and consuming it, and they had the money or the resources to do lots of research and seeds and so on. Coffee is very different. There's not that kind of central body or tradition. Until recently, there wasn't a kind of a big central body, really. There's no Monsanto for coffee. Another thing is that there's really no market for the seeds. A farmer will simply take the seeds from the best producing trees and kind of replant those. There's another reason, but it's very different. Been neglected for a long time, and this is something that the scientific community is very much aware of, and that many people say to you, we're 20 years too late. This is something that trying to fight climate change and certain diseases now, they say, I wish we would have done this 2 decades ago, but we didn't have this central organization to kind of help coordinate it.
Why was there no central organization?
Well, it was because of this. It was largely, being produced in countries that didn't have the resources. And the big ones like Brazil and Colombia tended to do a lot of the research for their own coffee sectors. So you had a lot of smaller countries that didn't really have the resources for that.
So let's talk about Brazil for a moment. How much of the coffee production is consumed by Brazilians?
That I'm not sure. I don't know. But you know, Brazil is the world's largest producer of coffee and the world's largest producer of Arabica. It is by far the biggest producer of coffee, and it's also one of the areas, or one of the countries that is particularly threatened by climate change. You know, the most recent, or some of the most recent studies basically have said that an increase of 2 to 2.5 degrees Celsius would trim perhaps by 50% the land suitable for growing coffee by 2050. Now, Brazil, that basically produces half of the world's Arabica and about a third of the total coffee, a rise of 3 degrees Celsius would cut, studies show, about two-thirds of the available growing land in the main or in the principal growing regions of the country. It's a very big issue. And this is simultaneously going on with demand, which is growing like crazy. So whereas, yes, and you know, old what they call old
Are
consumers,
there
so
new
say in the US
consumers of
it's been a long time
coffee?
producing
Or just.
consuming country, it's increasing. You know, the millennials are drinking more coffee than their parents, or drinking earlier than the parents, and then drinking better coffee. And then you have all these newer countries. You know, India, for instance, is, you know, coffee is booming in India. It's huge. Yeah, it's kind of growing all over the world. So demand is increasing. And at the same time, when the earth is really saying, you know, slow down, it, basically demand is saying by 2030, production will have to increase by one third. Or if you look at it this way, it has to increase by the same amount that Brazil is producing today. That's it's a huge increase. So rather than decreasing production, which is really what, you know, we need to do, because when you decrease in production, by that I mean not just somewhat less planting, but if you start producing coffee, for instance, with more shade, a lot of more shade-grown coffee, you start decreasing the yields. So if a farmer switches to, you know, producing coffee under heavy shade, maybe organic farming, maybe they're going to lose 30% of what they're farming now. So the, you know, they
It looks like there are real problems coming down the road because the heat, global heating, global warming will affect coffee production, and monocultures are always vulnerable. And that's the character of
yes.
South.
And Arabica in particular is really vulnerable because it's genetically impoverished. One, because of its history, how it spread, and second, it's self-pollinating.
I wonder if you could explain what you mean by self-pollinating and non-self-pollinating.
Yes, Robusta needs another plan. Let me back up here. Self-pollinating basically is that it can reproduce itself. They think it's not exactly known, but maybe 90% of the time, something like that. 95% maybe. Robusta is different. It needs to be cross-pollinated. And when you cross-pollinate, you get an almost unlimited number of kind of what they call genotypes. And this means that almost every tree is a little bit different. So basically, the trees that, you know, can succeed and adapt to certain changes survive and pass on those traits. Arabica being, you know, self-pollinating is much more sensitive, and much less able to withstand, you know, whether it's the heat or certain diseases that come through.
They could all just die. In other words, they cannot benefit from traits that would exist in certain plants, but not in others.
Yes. I mean, this for any species, this is genetic, you know, diversity is absolutely fundamental in survival.
What do you think the approaches to this problem, how successful are they?
Well, it's not only simply a matter of heat, because the climate change is making a disease called coffee leaf rust is aggravating. It's making it spread faster and quicker. And this rust is really one of the biggest threats for Arabica. It's been around for, you know, last handful of decades. And, you know, in Latin America, which produces about 85% of the Arabica, this is a really big issue. It's not something that can be cured. It can be dealt with, but it's not going to go away. And, you know, part of dealing with that is, you know, not monoculture farming, but, you know, more, for instance, if you farm with a lot of shade trees closer to what you get, you know, in the original forests of Ethiopia, it can help a bit with the increase of heat, but can also perhaps help a little bit with the coffee rusting. And this kind of monoculture that you kind of mentioned is always more susceptible to problems.
I'm wondering if increasing the cost of coffee at the consumer level would have any effect.
Well, one of the big issues, as I mentioned earlier, is that if a farmer is suddenly plants a lot of trees and is growing, you know, really heavy shade grown coffee, maybe the production is going to go down 20-30%, and that farmer needs a way to make up that money. You just can't say to a farmer, you know, plant all these trees, you're going to lose 30% of your yield, but that's how it is. You have to offer that farmer a way to make up that 30%. But there's no system at the moment to, you know, to offer that. I mean, obviously, I think in the future, I think that there could be or needs to be a way to somehow some premium for much more environmentally friendly coffees. I think people would pay. I mean, we don't want to pay more than for our coffee than we have to. But there's going to have to be some hard decisions made, some sort of, you know, in the past, it's been the past, you know, say 10 years, people said, well, Brazil can just make it up. But, you know, Brazil is having their own issues with drought and the heat, and it has to be dealt with. But as I said, there was no major central organization 20 years ago saying, well, we're going to deal with this in the future. Let's do this. You know, this is something that's now come about. There's a couple of agencies now that have kind of trying to take control and trying to get funding from the industry, from companies like Starbucks or, you know, large companies that, you know, their livelihood is in coffee, to try to deal with this. One, you know, issue of coffee is that it takes a number of generations. You know, we say you have a new plant that is maybe a little bit more stronger against a certain disease or something. It takes 3 or 4 years for each generation to grow before, and it takes you, you know, a handful of generations of a tree before you can know if it's successful or not. And so you're talking, you know, in some cases, you know, 15, 20 years before you can get these kind of new plants out to a farmer. And in today's scenario, like a lot of science will say, it just is not gonna work. And so science is coming in now, sequencing the genome and so on, to try to help speed up this process a little bit, making certain choices for the scientific community a bit easier. But it's as I said, a lot of people say we should have done this 20 years ago, and we should have been where we are right now 20 years ago. You know, this is, it's kind of overtaken a little bit. It's pretty severe. I mean, the problems that are happening in a lot of countries, you know, with Arabica.
Yeah. Here are two things that occur to me. The first thing is people are paying more for coffee because people are buying, as you say, better quality coffee, special. The definition of coffee as being special has just triumphed. And then the other thing is, like many other crops, basic food crops, rice and corn, global crops, we can't just say now grow twice as much as you have been growing on your farm.
Well, the largest growing sector of the coffee industry is the specialty coffee industry. You know, people are drinking better coffee, which is great. Everybody wants the best coffee. And people are paying a lot more for the cups of coffee, but actually on the, you know, on the commodities market, the price of coffee is actually quite low. I mean, certainly there's a famous $6 cups of coffee now, but that's not reflected in, you know, many farms. Yirgit Chefe is probably the most famous coffee producing area in Ethiopia. Some of the most expensive coffees, some of the most celebrated coffees in the world are coming out of Yirgit Chefe. And you go to Yirgit Chefe and it's just as impoverished as anywhere, and the farmers are making almost nothing. You know, the money is, it doesn't really trickle down so well.
Isn't this the thing that has to change?
I don't know. I mean, it seems that there has to be some large and some difficult decisions made, you know, to help finance some of this and to kind of make it more feasible to alter kind of a style of farming. How that's going to come out, I don't know. I mean, if the major companies, you know, say we're going to offer this premium and put it towards that, you know, Nestle controls 47% of the global coffee market, and is another company called JEB that controls almost an equal amount of it. I mean, it's two companies that are controlling almost the entire world's coffee market. You know, it's up to, and then Starbucks, it's up to some big companies to, I would say, step in, because it's not really a governmental agency that's there that's going to instigate it or police it.
So the fact that it's been the problems involved with coffee production are always being dealt with nationally, but not internationally. Research and FAO, you would think, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, would be playing a role in this. Do they have a role in it?
Well, they certainly were. You know, they were the ones behind, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, in the 1940s, they basically had said, you know, coffee is the world's second largest commodity at that point, yet we know almost nothing about it in the wild. And they, the FAO, they sponsored a couple of trips into Ethiopia, into the wild forest, to try to collect as much of that, of the wild, and well, actually from all over Ethiopia. But they were the ones instigated these major expeditions of gathering at that time.
Was that the gathering expedition of Frederick Meyer?
Right. There was a couple in there. And those, you know, the resources that they gathered, they're still using in breeding purposes. I mean, they really didn't know anything about it. And they continue to use the resources gathered, you know, back 50, 60 years ago.
So actually, there was research, but it's just old. And it has not been ongoing.
Yeah, they helped, but it tends to be national, on the national level. You know, there was some help in some countries in some areas, and they established in Costa Rica. You know, there was a major international, Katia was established center, but largely it's, you know, Brazil has its national industry and does its research for Brazilian farmers. Colombia handles Colombia. But where there used to be, you know, the agriculture of these countries, some of these countries, you know, especially after independence, there was, you know, not that much money for the research and development, and some of the really smaller countries.
So that is part of the problem, that the resources in the producing countries are not there.
Right. But even today, you know, some scientists said to me, you know, it's only a matter of numbers. You know, you develop a new, you know, strain of rice, and you have there's a lot of funding. But with coffee, I mean, who's going to give it to you?
I would like to keep on talking about coffee for another few hours, but we are going to instead, I'd like to ask you, what lays ahead beyond coffee for you? Do you have a new project you're working on?
Not yet. I mean, my last book was about tea, and specifically Darjeeling tea. And that book, you know, was basically about a plant that wasn't from a place and was smuggled out and planted elsewhere, and it found its perfect home. And the story about, you know, why it's there and how it got there and the culture that developed around it and the problems today. And so when I was working on that, I thought a lot about things in their origin. which is what led to the coffee book, because this book is in many ways the opposite story. It's about the plant looking at it in its natural home in Ethiopia. And so, you know, looking at plant at tea and then at coffee, I mean, it's hard for me not to also think about the story of chocolate or cacao. I think is, you know, as soon as I can find an interesting way to tell that story, something I would love to do.